Hello, and welcome to the Tea Leaves Podcast, where we bring Asia to you through conversations with the people whose lives and work are shaping the Indo-Pacific region.
India's done a really good job at sort of raising the platform and introducing a bunch of conversation. I think that Brazil and South Africa in the next couple of years will need to figure out where that goes.
I'm Rexon Yu, president of the Asia Group.
And I'm Valerie Rosman, principal and director of research and analytics at the Asia Group.
All right, we're back here at Tea Leaves. Valerie, good to see you.
It's good to see you, Rexon.
I'm super excited. We have Anand Shah back with us today. Anand joined us early in July to talk about the summit between Prime Minister Modi and President Biden when the Prime Minister visited Washington, D.C. Anand is a leading expert, incredibly knowledgeable on India, having lived there, worked there, and founded a whole raft of companies. So I'd urge our listeners to go back and take a listen to our first podcast after this one. Welcome back, Anand.
Thank you. Always great to be here.
Anand, we're so excited to have you here today to talk about the recent G20 Leader Summit that India hosted. I know there were some surprises. We can't wait to dig in with you to talk about what it all means.
Great.
So thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. It was an interesting G20 summit, to say the least. I think quite ceremonial, almost had a sort of circus-like element to it, but in a very valuable way.
So just on that, Anand, I've visited India 3 times this year, and every time that I've gone, G20 plastered everywhere in every city that I visited. Can you just set the stage and give us your take on what were the Prime Minister's priorities for this G20?
Well, I think that, you know, the first and biggest that he made very clear in several speeches was that the G20 had to move from being a global GDP growth consensus to being more human-centric. And to the extent that you could use an event like the G20 to embody that, I think India had pulled out every stop. They had, you know, over 200 meetings in 60 different cities in India. They turned it into something retail that even a common man in India would know what G20 meant, which, you know, you might have to push far into the beltway to understand that. Yep. In DC on a normal basis. So you suddenly have 1.5 billion people in India, you know, talking about the G20. But I think more importantly, you know, the objective of making what the G20 talks about relevant to large swaths of society, that was an attempt. And I think it's too early to tell whether that was successful or not, but they certainly tried.
And how do you see the priorities of the G20 overlapping with what the Prime Minister and his team have been pursuing in initiatives for India?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think India finds itself in a really interesting place, perhaps by creation, perhaps by circumstance, where it is developed enough to be seen as a shining light of how you might be able to move forward at a moment like this, but still developing enough to be very relevant to other countries that have a lot to learn. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in that sense, I think that India also finds itself at a time where things like climate change are really significant issues, right? You know, they're an energy user. They're going to continue to grow. They've made very significant commitments to being carbon neutral / deploying renewables. They've fulfilled most of those ahead of the curve, even though many other countries have not. It's also rapidly digitizing, you know, largest smartphone user base in the world, you know, cheapest data in the world, you know, that they're also facing all of the challenges that the rest of us are at a time that is fresh. You know, it also needs to continue to lift people out of poverty. And that means growth opportunities. It means leveraging geopolitics, manufacturing, etc. So I think you saw all of those topics front and center, with India being this sort of middle country that isn't necessarily involved in the tense debates of the world, but has a role to play, isn't necessarily, you know, deeply in poverty that no one has any hope for, and isn't yet a global, fully developed superpower. And I think it really sort of played that role well.
Mm-hmm. On that note, Anand, about how India played that role really well and brought a lot of various countries together, all of whom have different kind of strategic priorities and interests. One of the outcomes, And it sounds simplistic to say, but one of the key outcomes was that they actually were able to release a consensus-based declaration, a document from the leader summit, which is unusual this year because for the ministerial meetings, they had not been able to do that. So what do you attribute that to? And what does that mean about Modi's leadership on the global stage?
I think the greatest success of this G20, given that the headwinds against consensus were quite significant, the greatest success is the fact that India was able to pull off some kind of consensus. And I think that, you know, that wasn't without the little help from India's friends or even newfound friends in that sense, that there was willingness to have consensus, at least from one side of the table, that helped create consensus on the other. But I think from Prime Minister Modi's perspective of being this, again, country that isn't obviously on one side or the other, and being able to bring everybody to the table together. I mean, they launched this, you know, Middle East connectivity initiative that had, you know, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia and President Biden at the same table. And you wonder, you know, how many countries could pull that off in today's day and age, right? And bring consensus with Putin's Russia and Xi's China at a moment where there's so much tension around the world. So I think the, again, from a Modi perspective, this idea that the prime minister sees himself and sees India as being one of the few places that has the ability to play a role in finding consensus, mediating, bringing people together. Again, I think this G20, you know, at least did that to the best possible end you could have in a moment like this.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of the more concrete deliverables, the outcomes from the G20, there were a number of initiatives that were announced, including the Biofuels Alliance, the One Future Alliance, the Digital Public Infrastructure. Can you give us a sense of not only those initiatives, but others, like in your mind, what were those key deliverables and that will have some sort of tangible effect both on governments, countries, private sectors going forward?
Yeah, so I think, you know, if you follow their theme this year was One Earth, One People, One Future. I think, you know, One Earth, One Family, One Future. And it follows this very Indic term of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which means the world is one family, effectively. I think the outcomes flowed from that to the extent that there were really substantive outcomes. And the first is on climate. One Earth was very clearly about climate. It was very clearly about reminding developed nations of the role that they committed to, the commitments and finance for the global south to be able to take on climate mitigation objectives. They reminded the world of that, and there seemed to be consensus that the $100 billion a year that was supposed to be available and the trillions of dollars it's going to take, you know, it was very clear that there was a recognition that the South could not carry the burden of having to finance all of that on its own. So, you know, the first I would say is on the One Earth element from a climate consensus perspective, recognition that meeting targets was critical, if not more critical now than it has ever been, and that that is a collective effort and that, you know, different countries have different roles to play, including India as an implementer of many of these projects. The second on this idea of one family, I think largely was about inclusion. You know, it was SDGs being met. But I think the really big win there was the inclusion of the African Union. So, you know, at some level, it argued that there's a big chunk of the world that's been missing in this conversation, and we're going to bring them in. I think substantively, there was a lot in the declaration that talks about this, but nothing that I would consider a ginormous win. The last around this sort of one future really talked about the pressing challenges related to the interconnected world that we're in. A lot of that, you know, around digitization, given India's successes in digitization, but it also involved things around cooperation, like, you know, the Biofuels Alliance being about energy security, and it's something that the free flow needs to be able to happen around the world. It talked about elements of globalization, including Russia issues, while skirting sort of condemning Russia. They certainly made statements about the free flow of grains, for example, and, you know, not attacking things that are necessary for nations to be able to continue to grow, including energy infrastructure. So, you know, from my perspective, those really were the three elements. Having consensus on these pieces that basically said, look, you know, yeah, the world might feel like it's tearing itself apart, but we need each other in a bunch of different ways. And those need each other need to be sacred, including saving the planet, including lifting others out of poverty, including making sure that tough tasks that are coming up ahead of us include, you know, the way that technology is changing the world. AI, they talked a lot about, and having some sort of consensus globally on responsibility in AI, consensus on cryptocurrency as being, you know, not an instability factor in global economies, that sort of element. So, you know, I think it was very current in terms of conversation. You know, what happens next, I think it seems to me that if I were to make the argument, India's done a really good job at sort of raising the platform and introducing a bunch of conversation. I think that Brazil and South Africa in the next couple of years will need to figure out where that goes.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, part of the question I think that folks always have is, okay, you have these big meetings, you have long statements, you have consensus, but do things actually change? You know, what's practical? And kind of in that vein, Anand, you know, we've kind of touched on a couple times this question of the digital economy, digitization in India. And as we were talking about before we jumped on, you know, there's a desire to try to lift that up beyond what the Prime Minister has been pursuing in India to how this can help generate greater practical opportunity in other countries that continue to develop. Can you talk a little bit about the whole space of change in the digital economy and Prime Minister's particular initiative that he's been pursuing, the digital public infrastructure?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so for those that are listening that don't know, India has this really spectacular digital payment system that basically forces interoperability between bank accounts. And the government took on, you know, several things in the course of the Prime Minister's tenure of really trying to expand this. And so over the course of the last decade, pretty much everybody in India has a bank account. Banks are forced to operate those for free. You know, vendors on the street would rather take a digital payment than a cash payment, which for anyone who's lived in India 15 years ago thought that was impossible. You had wads of cash in your pocket all the time. You know, and so it's been a really, really big win for India. The World Bank, you know, released a report last week that suggested that because of some of these measures and the India stack, that, you know, India's financial inclusion story has been 10x faster. They say it would have taken 45 years to get to financial inclusion of this scale without the digital push. So India is very aware, the Prime Minister is aware, the government's very aware of how incredible a revolution this has been. They've left it in the open source world, right? In that they're wanting to license it to countries around the world to be able to do the same thing in their own way. And it's something the government's been pushing from India for the last couple of years. They've been, you know, trying to have a conversation with Canada about it. They've opened up remittances from the UAE. They've tied up with Singapore. There's conversation about potentially tying up, you know, in Saudi Arabia, in Japan. They want to move it to the global South and South America in particular, number of African countries. And so I think this idea that what India has done with financial inclusion for women, for, you know, far-flung communities, has relevance around the world. They've been trying to expand in two ways. One, they're trying to replicate the success of payments in other topics within the Indian market. So, for example, on e-commerce or on job marketplaces or on taxi services, like, can you create this digital infrastructure that puts in the public domain, the highway, and then lets private sector, you know, use that highway to generate growth. And then on the second, on the global side, they want to turn that into something that everybody's talking about and argues that inclusion in a digitizing world is necessary and, you know, can be equitable in terms of how it produces growth for everyone. And I think that's really what this is. And it's built all on the success of one payment system.
Is there an opportunity in the healthcare system in India?
They've done that already. So they've launched this national digital health mission that's designed to make medical records interoperable, for example, insurance marketplaces interoperable, for example. It's a heavy lift for a very market-driven sort of healthcare system within India. But, you know, I think that if it succeeds, it's extremely relevant to developed and developing countries alike.
Surprises out of the summit, Anand, from your perspective?
You know, I'm always looking for negative surprises. And, you know, to be frank, I don't think there were any any big ones in that sense, you know, I mean, other than Justin Trudeau getting stuck in India because he's playing, you know, and I think that was a bit of a, at least the reporting seems to be that there was a tense relationship between Canada and India at the moment. But I don't think there were any significant surprises. I think Xi not coming to the G20 was a preempted surprise before the G20 started. And the read seemed to be across the spectrum from, wow, this is this a snub from China to India, not wanting India to succeed? You know, there are a bunch of other things that happened. China released a map that really upset India in terms of how it counted its territory. It seemed that, you know, Biden was expecting to meet Xi on the sidelines. And there were a lot of things that could have happened. But the other end of the spectrum was, look, there's a lot going on at home in China. Both countries, India, China in particular, very warm in the way that they interacted with each other related to the G20. And the premier came to G20. They came to consensus, you know, spoke very positively about being able to work on the future. So I think that was attempting, people were attempting to turn it into a dramatic surprise, but I don't think it was, to be frank.
Yeah. On the geopolitical front, Biden also held a bilateral with Modi. Right. So I'm wondering to get, I would like to get your thoughts. How did this next leaders level meeting move forward the progress we saw during the summit here in DC earlier this year that you had talked about when we last had you on Tea Leaves? You talked a lot about the convergence between India and the US kind of writ large. So in your mind, how did this next meeting help move that forward?
Well, I think they doubled down on a number of topics, you know, like, you know, clean energy, climate impact, elements around the critical and emerging technologies ISET program, then, you know, talking about other topics that have been of importance, supply chain resilience and the role that India can play, high tech elements, including space, where, you know, India landed a lander on the moon. And, and that was a really big deal for India, but it also sent a signal to other countries that if India can do it at such a low cost, so can we. And, you know, everyone can shoot for the moon kind of thing. So there was, you know, it was, again, extensions of the warmth that you saw between the countries in June when the state visit happened. And there's more coming. Right? There's potential meeting at the APEC summit. You know, if that works out, there's Quad meeting in January or February in India.
Right.
Hopefully Biden will go to, you know, so, and, you know, I think that the absence of Xi also made the optics of Biden being there very significant. I mean, if you look at the photographs, like every picture has Biden in it and, you know, next to Modi. So I think that this idea that India and the U.S. are warming in their relationship, you know, in an unprecedented way, at least in the modern story of India, I think was very much at play. And if nothing else, this meeting one-on-one, the bilateral that happened the night before, just cemented that.
Yeah. It's interesting. You painted a picture of the absence of Xi sort of lifting up the Biden-Bodhi kind of image and what it means for that relationship. It's also, I hadn't thought about it until just now, by Biden not going to the ASEAN summits in Indonesia, it's sort of had that same effect of just lifting up the U.S.-India relationship symbolically.
Absolutely. And Modi was at the ASEAN summit for a day, you know, but China was absent there as well. So I think maybe this is just optics for the moment. Maybe there's something to read into it. Maybe not. I think it's too early to tell. But in this moment, the situation certainly created an opportunity for further warmth between the U.S. and India.
And we're still a number of months out from the next round of elections in India, but give us your current assessment of kind of what the landscape looks like and the strength of the prime minister's standing.
Well, it certainly helped that you had images for an entire week of the prime minister leading 20 global leaders through some of the most iconic places in Delhi and having conversations about the future of the world, very much in an Indian flavor. So I think that from a domestic politics perspective, if there was ever any doubt that India's stature had risen geopolitically over the course of Modi's tenure, you know, the G20 certainly cemented that feeling to everyone. There are a number of state elections that are happening towards the end of this year, in the next 3 months, that I think are fairly contentious. I suspect that some of this geopolitical optic will play into that in a positive way for the prime minister. But I think from across the board, everyone believes, and I can say that, you know, I think with almost a grand generalization that Modi goes into the central federal election next year very, very strong. And it seems that everyone in the opposition, you know, it really is representing a, you know, it's a Modi referendum. Either you like Modi or you don't. If you don't like him, vote for us. If you do, well, we can't win kind of thing. And I think that's how the election seems to be playing out. There's a lot of other nuanced dynamics of India and India using its Hindi name of Bharat related to this alliance that's happening. It's going to be a free-for-all season of all kinds of weird optics because that's how Indian politics is. It's a real interesting wrestling match of democracy. But I do think at this moment in time, given all of the tailwinds, that it seems very likely that Modi comes back into power and with a majority, which I think, you know, many would also think is very good at this moment in India's sort of political economy and development. To have some political stability bodes very well to folks who are looking to invest in India and look for policy stability, look for predictability. And I think this government has gotten much better at that as it's been incumbent for a while. That incumbency comes with the downsides. So we'll see how it all plays out, especially in the state elections. But, you know, if I were a betting man, I think that, you know, the odds are very significantly on Modi's side at the moment.
So looking positive, but buckle up.
Exactly.
It's an election.
Exactly.
It's an election in India.
not unlike the U.S. these days. So, you know, I think that right. it's buckle up everywhere.
All right. We will all stay buckled up, I think, for all of 2024.
That's right. We should just send red, white, and blue seatbelts out to everybody.
Anand, great to have you on again. Thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate the rapid fire update of what was a significant event, one that I thought in the U.S. media, you know, seemed a bit one dimensional as they focused on just the sort of Ukraine language, but so much more going on that you helped lay out for our listeners. So thank you.
Well, very good. I'm going to go off and build a G20 swag store now for the future because I think, you know, it's going to be a popular t-shirt.
One Earth, one family, one future.
That's right.
And thank you to our listeners. Please be sure to rate and follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you next time on Tea Leaves.